Hi, I'm Jessie.
Hi, this is Helen.
And we're Asian Bitches Down Under. It is now etching towards the middle of November.
Yes.
Everything's going fine over here in Sydney.
We are at now Dargin Jamlen. We just had a massive storm last night. And did you have storm in Sydney yesterday? Like, we had
We
massive
did, yeah. So I was out
storm. Yeah.
in Newtown. I went out with a friend to Tokyo Taco.
Oh,
There's
you went to Tokyo Taco again.
again, yeah, it's like my third or fourth visit. It's
Nice.
and I always get the same thing. It's
What's that?
quite reliably good. So for those who don't
Yeah,
know,
I think
it's
consistency is very important for restaurants and cafes.
oh yeah. It's like a sort of low brow but delicious rest. I wouldn't call it a restaurant, but it is like, I don't
Casual
know, like a
fast
cashew fast food,
food.
on King Street in Newtown. It is, of course, as the name says, half Japanese and half Mexican. And so, like yesterday, this is the last night was the first night I sat inside the store to eat, and I noticed that inside there was a mural, like a huge wall, where there
Oh,
was a
that.
picture, like a picture, like a painting of a Japanese looking old man wearing a sombrero. And I was like, oh, this is the visual kind of depiction of what we're doing here, eating half Japanese, half Mexican food.
That's actually quite clever.
It's so funny, man. It's hilarious.
I got back to listening to some podcast that I haven't listened for a while, and this week I've been listening to The Guilty Feminist, and
The Guilty Feminist. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I always want to do
We
this on
are.
a podcast, but we never do, as in like
What's
saying
that?
that we're feminist, but we're guilty of doing
But
something that when it's not very feminist.
oh, not proud. Yeah, but I have a lot of complex feelings about that because I did start listening to the episode in which Helen actually said to me a few days ago. It was the best of Cal Wilson,
That
who
one.
is of course a tremendous comedian who sadly
Sadly
passed
passed
away at
away.
an extremely early age, like 2, 3, 4 weeks ago. Maybe actually back in September. I remember this now. Yeah. No, sorry, October. It was mid-October. She had passed away. And I started listening to it, and it was really funny. I remember the opening sort of bit in the episode was like she said, you know, someone's given a stop caring about the world when they've cut their hair short and dyed it. And like
That's
had,
me.
no, actually, she said colored glasses when you have
Yes.
like bright colored glasses. And I just thought of Annabelle Crabbe and her bright red glasses.
There are a lot of TV personalities. If you look around, I feel like there are a lot of TV personalities, particularly women, 50 or maybe 45 plus,
Yeah.
will start wearing very bright colorful glasses frame.
Yeah. Yeah.
I wonder if that's a sign of what Carl Wilson had said, that you just don't give a fuck anymore, and also that you just want to be yourself. Like,
I love
why
that.
not?
I love that.
Why do you have to conform to a certain outfit standard that everyone follows?
Yeah, my Pilates teacher is has short spiky hair. She's like the algorithmic rendition of what you think of when you think of like if someone from the 90s thought lesbian. Short spiky black hair with really funky glasses, and she's like the warmest human being ever, just like super warm and sweet. And I just love the vibe that she gives. She's someone who I just think, yeah, she's like reached an age where she gives zero fucks about what people think about her. And it's great. My favorite bit from the Cal Wilson episode from The Guilty Feminist is when she says, I'm a feminist, but when I don't want, like when a tradie comes to my house and I don't want something fixed, I say to them, I'll just have to ask my husband about this. I just have to ask my husband for permission. I love that.
That's so funny. I think she was saying that. Oh no, she was approached by a salesperson or something like that. Yeah, public place. Yeah. To be honest,
And I
I did
love
that
that actually.
before. I did that before
Really? Yeah.
myself.
And I love that actually the other host woman just actually says, actually, it's a condition of you women being unable to say no.
That's very true.
We do everything. We like go, we can lie our asses off. We'll do anything just to actually prevent, just to v avoid saying no, because like we're conditioned to just not be rude to people and not refuse people.
Yeah.
And I thought, yeah, because like for me, I am also someone who just like finds it deeply uncomfortable to say no. Like I find it like my whole body just like starts throbbing with fear at the idea of like refusing someone or like refusing someone's request or letting someone down or just like putting my own comfort first.
It's a behavior that we really need to unlearn, but it's not an easy thing to do, I think, because I'm guilty of doing that, you know, saying that, just like moving all the responsibility to my husband, saying that, oh, I have to ask my husband and check. But I know I'm not gonna accept that sale, but
yeah,
I just find it, I don't know, like I have no practice of saying no.
Yeah.
When we were growing up,
exactly.
Use, therefore, that the easiest excuse that I can use,
yeah.
Oh, my husband might not want this, so I have to check with my husband.
Yeah, like, yeah.
You have an invitation from someone, and you don't want to go, and you know that your husband would not fucking care.
Yeah.
You just bring out your husband. But I think husbands will do the same as well. They will bring out their wife as an excuse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because we're so uncomfortable with saying no.
Yeah. What are you guilty of as a feminist? We really ask ourselves before. Can you think of
I feel like I am still very much I still buy into that I need to be skinny. I think that's the main thing with me. God, yeah. I still buy into the whole bodily thing. That's my worst unfeminist trait. Like, I still care about how other people perceive me.
Mm-hmm. It's very same for me. I think I still found it hard. Like, I'll admit that I have a very high tendency of body anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
And also appearance anxiety as well. To be very specific is that, Jess, you would know that whenever that we take photos, I will always judge myself.
Yeah, really harshly.
I'm so bad.
Yeah.
I'm terrible at looking the photos I took for myself. I will always say, I look fat, my skin doesn't look good, or it just doesn't look nice. And I've become so self-conscious that I hardly post any pictures of myself like on social media before, and usually we just post my dogs or my kids, but I don't really like taking photos as well. But it becomes so bad that ever since I became a mother, and also a mother of a daughter, that kind of shift my mentality with how much that I'm so critical of myself, because I know that it will affect how my daughter perceive her own self as well.
Yeah, totally.
But I think my daughter is such a strong feminist because she will always encourage me. She's such a, you know, like a cheer squad for me. She would say that, no, you look good, you know, don't think like that. So it's so amazing coming from the
actually I think
that. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
yeah. I wonder why we grew up like that. Like I constantly think about why we have that kind of thinking as an adult, that we still couldn't let go of that anxiety. I think one of the reason for me personally, I don't know about how you perceive this, but for me personally, is that because our mother is such a beautiful woman. She's a very mainstream beauty.
Mm.
And I always feel like growing up, you know, being her daughter is like not a shadow, but yeah, you're living under her shadow, and
yeah, it's very hard.
It's very hard.
I agree.
Do kind of be, she is critical about how we look as well. I'm in my 40s, and sometimes if I have a pimple on my face and turn up at our mom's house, and she would say that, why do you have a pimple on your face?
What, really?
Yeah, she would still question me that, oh, you have to be under your skin, and I go, oh, okay, yeah. Mm. So, yeah, I don't know how other people deal with it, apart from
therapy. Yeah, I mean, I have a lot of thoughts about this.
Mm-hmm.
I think Anne Patchett, like the famed American author whose books I absolutely adore.
Mm-hmm.
And my favorite book of hers is actually a memoir. It's Truth and Beauty. It's not her novels are great, but my favorite book of hers is Truth and Beauty, which really changed my life. In many ways, it was about her friendship with her friend Lucy. I forget her surname, but she was like a very dear friend who they had went to Iowa's Writers Workshop together, I think in the 80s or the 90s. And it's about that both of their journey into like working out what their own beauty is and their own power mm-hmm. in beauty. Because, you know, in this world, unfortunately, women are still primarily judged by our beauty and valued mm-hmm. by our beauty. And so therefore, when you don't have beauty, when you don't have the currency of, you know, conventional beauty, it's really, really difficult, I have to say, as a woman, mm-hmm. in the same way that in this world, it's very, very difficult to be a man and not be tall, because that's like the first, like 90% of someone's first impression of a man is like their height, which I really don't understand, but I guess like that's just the way things are. I mean, that's not the conclusion that I'll draw if I had like more time to get into it, but just for the sake of this conversation, being not pretty as a woman is like being not tall as a man. Mm. And I mentioned Ann Patchett because I remember her saying that her mother is also very, very beautiful. And then she said that growing up, it's very difficult to grow up as a daughter of a woman who's stunning. Yes. And I feel like definitely I don't feel that for you, Helen, because I think you're very, very pretty. Like, you know, and also my sister, the other sister, our other sister, also very pretty. And I have felt like the odd one out. Like I've always felt like I'm in the shadow of, like I feel the same way you feel about our mother, because she is like just like Hollywood, like our mother is Hollywood good looking. Mm-hmm. And it's like there's a certain really deep, and it's a sort of like a shameful pain to, I think, I feel like it's a very shameful pain that I've struggled with, because it's like silly, you know, because I feel like it feels trivial to like be sad about the fact that I'm not as pretty as my mum, you know, it's stupid, and yet it still exists, and yet it's still there, you know.
I think it exists because the way that how we were brought up, because our mum is very traditional and she sees the value of being
traditional. Beautiful. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
The prices that she had to pay is enormous. You know, the time that she need to keep herself. I remember our mum usually would take, you know, she's already very beautiful without makeup, that she, in order to keep that beauty, that she takes out, not hours, but at least an hour if we're going to go out somewhere. Family had to wait for her. And then when I become a teenager, she will be critical of me, saying that she didn't really directly saying that why am I fat, but she will be asking me that why are you eating that much, or you shouldn't be eating that much. So I think it's because being the first daughter of, you know, the whole her children, she is more critical of she feels like it's more critical for her to discipline her eldest daughter she will worry about how other relatives and friends perceive her as well, like how your child will become is a reflection of a parent. And I feel like I'm constantly being judged by her. So even if you say that I am beautiful, and no doubt that my friends had said that as well, but I don't feel that, I don't have the confidence deep enough to say that I'm beautiful myself, because of how, you know, our most intimate person, our mother for our life, has never really complimented me. So I guess like you, it's like a pain that I find to struggle probably for a lot more years to come that I will need to see therapy for.
Still do see a therapist.
Yeah, and that's why I learned from our mother. That's why I never judge, you know, or I never outright, I wouldn't say outright, but I wouldn't talk about appearance with my kids, especially with my daughters that much, and everything you'll be like positive, or I try to be, like, you know, you don't, I don't want her to become so self-conscious about how she will look like, and that will stop her being herself. Where are we gonna leave from here?
We'll lead straight into Quiz Lady.
Because I know we're gonna have a huge discussion about Quiz Lady, but I want
I wanted to add actually I was thinking about just, I mean, it's really not specifically about the issue of body shaming or like this issue of beauty that we're talking about, but it is kind of related to this issue of like you refracting your sense of what means like what it means to be a parent and what kind of parent that you want to be refracted through the experience of you that you have had. I've been thinking about it because like I'm kind of loosely interested in dad father pods, and so like, you know, so for instance Hamish Blake and his whole spiel about, you know, how other dads dad, that podcast that I'm kind of mildly obsessed with, now I can't find myself able to go there for an hour and listen to dudes, like straight dudes, talk about how wonderful their daddying is when they're like not there, probably not there like more than half the time. But anyway, what I've noticed, and also Maggie Dent, the parent expert, I just have that in quotes, you know, she's made herself the parent expert of Australia. She has a new podcast, and it came out a few months ago, and where she interviews young, or not young, she interviews Australian dads about their dadding method. I'm using the word dadding as a verb, like Hamish Blake came up with that. Okay, yeah. But male parenting, yeah, it's a really awful adjective, verb, whatever, yeah. But anyway, what I've noticed, Helen, what I've noticed is that they really stress the need to always keep telling them their child, like, I love you no matter what. Like they say it's so important, like no matter what your child does, the first thing you're supposed to do, and the thing that they keep overpraising is that, oh, my child did this, but the first thing I want them to do, or the first thing I make sure that they feel is that I love them unconditionally. And I'm just like, it's so weird and like it makes me irk in a way, because I feel like the reason, I'm not saying that a child shouldn't grow up feeling unconditional love. I'm saying that's like important, obviously, but there must be some other way other than just to say I love you, because this seems like what the guys do on these podcasts with Hamish Blake. They often just say over and over again, oh, whatever my child does, the first thing I do is make sure I say to them, I love you. I don't care what you did, I still love you. Daddy loves you, you know? And they say that over and over again. But the thing is, I keep reflecting on like my upbringing, and obviously you and I, we grew up in an immigrant family, and we don't like in immigrant families, speech, the love language of speech and verbal, it's just that they exist. Yeah, we do like nothing. It's more like I hate you, you know. I mean, I'm not saying our parents said I hated you, but it's like, yeah, it's there's like no verbal communication when it comes to intimacy,
affection,
affection and affection. Yeah, good one. And so like I actually grew up feeling like deeply like, I'm not going to say like, I'm not going to go on this pod and blame our parents for anything, because I think they did a stellar job and I love them to death. They're like the two most important people in my life for sure, hands down. I feel like I am me, and I am the curious and like really crazily ambitious when it comes to wanting to write books person, because I didn't feel loved. Like I feel like the fuel for my life is actually this lack of feeling unconditional love. So I wonder what it would have been like to grow up, if I did grow up in, say, just a white family, or just a family in general that where like unconditional love is drummed into me. I wonder what kind of human being I would be today. I know definitely I would not be someone who wrote books. I know that for sure. I'd probably just be an accountant or a lawyer, or like someone with like a stable 9-to-5 job. I guess if I explore that logic to its nth degree, then someone can say that I was espousing the idea that art needs to be created through tragedy or trauma, which I also don't believe in, you know?
There's a lot of theories behind that, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm kind of like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Still thinking about it.
Yeah, this is very, this is a big differences between East and the West culture when it comes to expressing love.
But yeah.
I think a lot of Asian communities and podcasters have talked about this, where most of the Asian immigrants, children of Asian immigrant families, never grow up being really expressed, being, you know, they don't feel like they're loved. But definitely the parents have expressed in a different way, is because the parents themselves never
knew
about how to verbally express their affection to their child, their children. The only way that they can do is they need to survive. I think survival is the imminent priority for most immigrant families, and also families of refugees.
Yeah.
You know, you need to survive. What are you talking about? This love, unless that you can live, there's no talk.
No
about
loving.
That.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we need to slowly look at that, how, you know, the children of immigrants and also our children, the next generations, the following generations, need to know how we can also verbally express our affections to them, besides cutting fruits, besides, you know, packing their lunch, besides, you know, supporting them financially. And also maybe just, I guess there are a lot of things that we can change as parents in this generation that we can look into. Obviously, I don't, like, even though that I agree that it is important to say that you love your children, but I don't think it is wise to say it in the way that it's shallow. As in, sometimes people say, like, for me, when I hear people say, when I first hear the concept, you know, you can verbally express your love through saying that, but you need to mean it, because sometimes you have people that say it, but they don't really mean it. And you do get perhaps parents. I would like actually like to see, I would like to hear the experience of the people who grow up with a family who had their parents constantly saying they love them. And when it comes to a need from the children that they don't just need verbal expression of love, they need support, perhaps financially, or maybe they need something else, but the parents won't be able to provide them, how would they feel about that?
Yeah.
Everyone's degree of love and their concept of love is very different.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I just irk at the sort of totality in which these, like, dad pods, they keep stressing the importance of, like, saying I love you to their kids. Because, like, I guess, like, when you're a 3 or 4 or 5-year-old, you don't understand acts of service. Maybe you don't understand, like, gift giving. Maybe gift giving is something they understand, but, like, kids, their minds haven't developed in a way where they understand what love is. I mean, who knows what love is? Like, you know, adults don't know what love is. Mm. But, like, it feels to me inadequate. You know, yeah. It feels inadequate to just simply rely on the act of saying I love you to a child. For them to feel like for them to feel what you want them to feel, kind of. Like, I feel like this is reminding me of the book that I've written that's coming out next year, The Honey Eater. Mm-hmm. And it's about a translator. And it really, the idea of the book really came out from this conversation I had with Tiffany Chow, who is a translator, Australian, Singaporean translator. Where she said that in the West, there's this fundamental idea that when you have a feeling or an emotion, you express it. Or if you have an anxiety, you talk through it, right? Like, you verbally express it and you let people around you know about it. That's like a way of connecting. That's like a form of intimacy that is kind of like undeniable, right, in the West. But she said, like, in the East, that form of connection and intimacy is actually seen as quite selfish. Like, in the East, you're supposed to suppress all your anxieties and your feelings for the comfort of those around you. And so, like, if you have some sort of like pain, or if you have anything that you're going through internally, the way to show your love to those around you is to actually suppress it, is to actually keep it to yourself. Because if you spread it, it's like a germ that you spread around, and it contaminates the people around you, you know. And I remember, like, distinctly having a fight with my dad, like our dad, when I was like 15 14, and like wanting him to understand this thing I was going through. And then he said something like, he just cut me off, because he was like, we don't talk about it, you don't need to tell me in words. I was like, but I'm trying to communicate through words something that I'm feeling. And he said, these feelings, they're not supposed to be given words. And I just remember that moment was like such a huge explosion in my mind, because it was a moment where I sort of like understood that he and I are fundamentally different as people. And I grew up in the West, he grew up in the East. And like, we had very, very conflicting ideas about what an intimate and intimate close relationship looked like, you know. And it was such a moment, because I kind of realized it was like sort of a small minor tragedy, because it was a moment in a point in my life where I realized in a way that we could never completely connect, perhaps, because we had such deeply conflicting ideas about what intimacy looks like, you know, between a father and a daughter. And actually, sort of continuing from that train of thought, the special friend I had dinner with last night, she's also a person of color, a woman of color, and she said to me this wonderful, amazing thing that I really connected with. And she said, the reason why she has built her life around trying to be extremely articulate, she's like one of the most, she is the most emotionally articulate person I know. She said it's because, like, she has this burning desire, this burning need to have people understand her.
Mm-hmm.
And like, using words is the only way she has learned that she could perhaps get people to understand what she's feeling, and therefore to feel seen. You know, when you say you want people to understand you, when teenagers go off on their little, you know, hissy fits, it's like, it's their crying to be understood, which is the same thing as wanting to be seen, right? But that's all we want to be. When we move through this world, every single human being, our MO, the only sort of like fundamental similarity we all have is the need to be seen, right? But like, as immigrants, like, I feel like it really resonated with me what my friend said last night, because I realized that's why I have really made an effort in my life to read a lot of books, and especially read a lot of feminist books, because it's in feminism and it's in the words of women who have died and written books and feelings that I have felt myself seen. Mm-hmm. And I've used their words in my own vernacular in order for people, like, in order to like try to be seen, you know, because I have definitely grown up feeling like I haven't been understood and seen, because you and I, our parents literally don't have the same language as us, like literally not the same language, you know.
Yeah. It's so very hard for kids growing up in immigrant families, and like you said, and your friend said, that the differences of emotional expression from your friend, the differences between the East and the West, is so, I can't even find a word for it. Just, you know, in the East, we consider that you don't talk about those feelings because you don't want to trouble other people. You don't want to put burdens on other people while they're still trying to survive, you know? And that's justifiable. I think that's understandable. But it comes to a time that we just have to move forward, because if we don't talk about all these feelings and you don't get to let other people to know you or know about you, you eventually die from suffocating, you know, emotionally, literally. And I learned this the hard way when I have started going out with my husband, you know, like decades ago. He would just be baffled of why that I am angry at things, and I can't find words to tell him why I'm angry. And because I always thought the only intimacy, the partnership I've seen was between our parents. And our parents have this idea of you don't have to say it and someone else is already know. That means love, which is such a fucking misconception.
Yeah. Like Rowan Keating's "When You Say Nothing at All." That song is the biggest misconception about what love is. But also a great song.
Our parents always believe that they always have to prepare things for the other person without the other person saying it to them. That is love.
Yeah, zero communication equals best communication.
And I grew up believe that, oh, when I fall in love with someone or someone loves me, they supposed to know what I'm thinking. And that was
no
just,
way. No, so, I'm not, yeah.
Just, the first few years of our relationship was just so hard because he's trying to get me to talk and I have no words to how to describe my feelings. I mean, 20 years afterwards, we're a lot more better because I open up and I understand that the importance of communication, the importance of expressing, you know, your emotion.
I'm so glad it worked out.
And I see this in a lot of mixed culture couples as well. Like one person believes that someone else should already know what they think or what they want. And the other person is just totally confused. Yeah.
I'd never know what goes on in anyone's head, honestly.
Yeah. Because one day early in our relationship, my husband back then, he was my boyfriend. He's like, if you don't tell me, I am not a mind reader. I'm not a telepathic.
Telepathy?
Yeah, telepathic. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I can't read your mind. You have to tell me.
Mm.
I had always assumed that when people are in relationship, you're supposed to know what to do.
No.
So communicate with your partners, communicate with your families. That's the way that you're trying to get through them. And communication, verbal communication is something that human has, no other animal has. Animal has all other sort of forms of communication, but we have such a variety of communicative forms, writing, speaking.
Yeah, it's so interesting. And then now with sort of like sort of limitlessness and the expansive world of technology, you know, everything that we have as humans, like in the last 5 gazillion billion, however many years we've been on this planet, I think what ultimately we've wanted to do with everyone around us is try and communicate that in order to be seen, right? In order to feel understood. Yeah. And it's so startling to think that even with all these new communicative tools and even people who speak the same language, right? Like I'm lucky I get to communicate with you in the same language, like in English. And everything is an attempt to just get as close as possible to seeing, being seen, and also seeing other people for who they truly are.
Mm-hmm.
And it feels to me like at the moment, verbal communication and being like verbally kind of articulate and finding words to express emotional feelings, that's still the, I guess, the superior means in which I find myself like leaning on in order to make that connection with people.
Mm-hmm. Well said. Yeah, totally agree with that. Hi there. If you're new to our show, thanks for tuning in into our program, and we hope you will stay with us for a very long time. And if you're a regular listener, we're forever grateful for your continuous support throughout this period of uncertainty. It has really helped this podcast to gain a great exposure, as our mission is to center the perspectives of people who look like us, who are marginalized historically to the sideline of conversation. So if you haven't already, we encourage you to subscribe to our podcast on Omni, Apple, Google or Spotify and leave a rating and review. And of course, as a small podcast program, we rely on listeners' support to continue this work. Please do check out our Buy Me Coffee page and make a donation in order for us to continue to advocate the intersectionality in the podcast industry. Let's jump into cultural consumption of this week. I want to start off with something that's probably not very age appropriate for me because I haven't.
There's no such thing as, like, you could read The Very Hungry Caterpillar. Who cares?
I've been delving into manga the last few weeks and just reading some of the Taiwanese illustrators' work. And also I picked up a book that I got for my daughter ages ago. And I know that she's been following this writer for a very long time. So I bought this book earlier this year for her. And I picked up from her room one day when I was trying to pick up her laundry, dirty laundry on her bedroom floor. Anyway, so it's called Ghost Book by Remy Lai. And I got her this book because I know how much she loves Remy Lai. And I did, when I got this book, I didn't think that much of it. I just thought that, oh, okay, it's another Remy Lai work. She's going to love it. It's better for her. You will occupy her for, I don't know, an hour of the time because she reads so fast. Mm-hmm. So this, and when I start reading it, I'm like, oh my God, all the Asians in the West need to read this comic. Because it talks so much about the ghost culture,
yeah,
of the Chinese history. Oh, not history, not so much history, but just the legends behind the ghost world, the underworld, and
Ghost Month, which is around like September. I mean,
August, September.
Which features in my book, The Honey Eater, by the way. Like, I talk about all these, like, myths that I remember. One thing that has stuck with me when I grew up was, like, my mom, our mother, she would, like, insist every single night to take the clothes off the line out of the backyard. Because she said, she was so adamant. She was like, if you don't, the ghosts will, like,
will possess the
clothes. Yeah, exactly. And like she literally, like really, like it was a belief that was as strong as like the belief that the sky is green, sky is blue. You know, it's like it was really, really adamant. Like we would be driving hours away from some holiday, and if we weren't home by dusk, it's like shitfall, man. Like all hell broke loose because like the she would like have to take the clothes in by sundown.
Yeah, I think that's just one of the things that our mom trying to force us to bring our laundry in. It's not to do.
No, I don't do that.
Uses the fear factor to make us to do the chore.
Yeah, but do you do that? Do you take the? Do you bring the clothes down, or do you?
I don't really hang my clothes out, so I hang it in the.
Oh, okay.
My sunroom, so it dries pretty well. But I think it's. This has got nothing to do with ghosts, but I think it's just another fear factor that our mother gives us, like her cushion. That she,
if you sit on cushions, your ass will be numbed or something.
Rotten.
Is it because she didn't want us to sit on cushions?
She wanted us to, you know, her butts to sit on her cushions. That's why.
Because she thinks that we'll destroy the cushions. Is that why?
I think she's just our mom's OCD was germs and cleanness. She doesn't want anyone else to touch her stuff. Yeah. Well, anyway, coming back to Ghost Book. So it goes back to, for anyone who doesn't know much about Chinese culture on ghosts, this is a very good starting point, I think. This book, there's a lot of characters that is from... There are a lot of characters that are from the Chinese myth of the underworld. There's the, what's it called? Horse face and ox head? Niu tou ma mian, as in
the fawn.
The supervisors of collecting the souls from the human world. And there's also the wandering ghosts. There's also Yan Luo Wang, which is the king of the underworld. So this comic book follows the journey of a boy and a girl who's trying to find out who's actually supposed to be living. It's very, very heartwarming as well. And also because it's got a dog in this book. I love stories with dogs in them. So that's really cute. So Romy Lai ghost book. If you don't want to get the book, borrow from your library. Yeah, it will only take you an hour to finish this book, but it's such a wonderful little read for a relaxing afternoon, I think.
Yeah, Remy Lai is an Indonesian-born Singaporean Brisbane person. She now lives in Brisbane,
Yes, that's right.
which is really cool. Yeah, I don't mind Brisbane. It's Melbourne. It's Melbourne. I have a gripe.
Already lost so many listeners.
Oh, because of Melbourne? Yeah, sorry,
Brisbane.
sorry, folks. Yeah, I don't hate Melbourne folks. I just maybe I do actually. Did I actually say I don't like Melbourne people?
No, I
Maybe
think
I
you say
did
you don't like
say
the
that.
city. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's really sad. I don't know if you got time to go to the library. It's really sad at the end of the book because there's a departure of a certain creature that we all love.
Oh.
Yeah. That I hate to see because we talked about this before we start recording about how
Yeah,
a
yeah.
dog can
Well,
live.
it's related to yeah. Well, it's related to I guess what we're about to talk about, which is Quiz Lady, the focal point of our
Yeah, that's getting
episode. Yeah, so Quiz Lady dropped last week and on Apple, sorry, on Disney Plus. I found it on Disney when we opened it.
Hulu in the US.
Yeah. And texted Helen about it, and Helen was like, "Oh my God, it's dropped!" And then you watched it the same night. I really loved it. There are a lot of things I loved about it. I thought it was really great that they played sort of like conflicting what they usually play, like their type personalities, character personalities. So Awkwafina, historically has played crazy, in the hood kind of Bronx woman. Sandra Oh, I guess Sandra Oh has a much more diverse range of characters that she's played, but she plays like the crazy older sister who just like is like completely aimless and just like yeah, they're playing against type. I loved the way that in which they approached these characters. I thought it was so great, especially just the Awkwafina's hunch
I
was
know,
so
I
funny.
know.
I was like, is she
Oh my
does she
God. I mean, like, I
But
look
the
at
thing is, like,
Anna,
she also hunches in The Farewell. I feel like that's just Awkwafina's
okay.
look. Like, she's a very hunchy, kind of brooding kind of face. My favorite bit was actually, I think my most laugh out loud moment was when, I don't like violence of any sort, but I actually lost my shit. In the first scene where we see Sandra Oh's character, when she gets
She
hit by the
enters.
car.
She
Yeah,
enters.
in the back, you see her in the
Yes.
background and she gets hit by the car. It was just fucking hilarious.
You imagine that we're gonna have a lot of spoilers
Spoilers. Yeah,
for the next 20
definitely.
minutes? So,
Yeah.
Quiz Lady, directed by Jessica Yu, written and produced by Jane D'Angelo. So, Jess has probably talked about some of the narratives of this movie. It is a heartfelt comedy about estranged Asian American sisters and their a game show. So Anne Yum, which is a very funny, very strange Asian
Yeah, yum. It's a
Yum.
Cantonese, right?
I
I
think
feel like it's Cantonese.
the dad is Korean, so I don't
Oh,
really know
okay. Maybe
Yum
it's Korean. Yeah.
Korean surname. Anne is played by Awkwafina and her estranged train wreck sister Jenny, played by Sandra Oh. So they have to work together to help to cover their mother's gambling debt when Anne's beloved dog, Mr.
Oh my
Linguini,
God, Linguini is so cute.
kidnapped. Yeah. So they set out on a wild, like cross-country track to get cash by playing this game show.
Yeah, so Anne, played by Awkwafina, is like a genius at this
Game show.
show, game show. Yeah, and the host is Will Ferrell, and so basically, the game is the ultimate safe space for Anne, for Awkwafina's character. Like
Yes.
she watches, she's never missed a night for the last like 28 years. She's never missed a single night. Wait, she's 33. She the mess that there. She's in her early 30s,
Yeah, so
and
last
every
like
night she,
4 years.
yeah. And every night she watches it, she has her pet pug Linguini next to her, to her left, and she pats him. So that's like her safe space. And so yeah, it's basically the film is about Sandra Oh trying to convince Awkwafina to get on the show in order to make the money. Mm-hmm. And in the process, they connect and find each other again. So it's ultimately a story about sisterhood, mm-hmm. and one sister trying to push the other into her best self,
mm-hmm.
which happens at the end. And it's tremendous. And I thought my favorite scene was definitely the one where Sandra Oh gets run over. No, she doesn't get run over. She's pushed by a truck. The only scene that I didn't find plausible was the end when Awkwafina says to Sandra Oh, "I love you." Again, Asians saying verbally communicating love is just so inauthentic. It's so inauthentic. Yeah, it just doesn't happen.
It's not real as well. It's like we're trying to do it, but it just doesn't seem real.
Yeah. Just hug. That's enough, you know? Also, the emotional climax of the movie is enough. Like, it was a beautiful climax. It was absolutely beautiful.
I think that was done so clever. Apparently,
I know. I agree.
That scene at the very beginning, I've heard
it. They?
With the, was a Variety or Vogue, that the director shoot that scene, the very end scene, early on during the production.
Why?
She can get all the actors into that mode, as in they have that emotional connection with the whole production.
Yeah.
Purpose of shooting that at the very beginning. I think this is such an absolutely hilarious and clever script. It is very fast paced, and it's like a 1 hour and 40 minutes.
Perfect length, can I say? Perfect length. Yeah.
I love the cast. I think the portrayal of sisters' relationship is very real. It's so funny. You know, they're different traits. I can totally relate. I love the outfit. The outfit of Sandra Oh, whatever that she is, so great.
Yeah.
Our characters were brilliant as well. You know, like you say, Will Ferrell, which reminds me, I feel like I should watch Blaze of Glory with my kids.
I feel like that's a bit sexual. Maybe wait. Yeah, there's a lot of sexual content in Blades of Glory. Yeah,
I remember that was just really funny film. Yeah. Who else were in that movie?
Holland Taylor plays the single cat lady, old woman, problematic neighbor.
Yeah, the annoying. That's a neighbor. Stereotypical of an older.
I know it girl. Is. Oh, yeah, exactly. Single.
That's a bit toxic, I think.
Yeah. I agree. But Holland Taylor is, you know, an icon.
Yeah, she's
so
great.
They're like extremely, extremely lucky. It's extremely great that they got her. It really props up the film.
Uh-huh.
Jason Schwartzman plays the seedy antagonist.
Yeah, the annoying.
He's the champion of the quiz. Who Awkwafina comes in and beats. So that's brilliant. I love the scenes in the in the pet rescue.
The highlight for me as well.
The bad guy, the baddie in the movie is like a guy who steal dogs or something? Or I think they rescued
their dog shelters.
Dog shelters, yeah. And there was one character dog who I wanted to mention called Crispy, and I just thought that is the perfect name for a dog. If I ever had a dog, I would call it Crispy. Isn't that cute? Crispy.
Where that Jenny, played by Sandra Oh, crashes into that dog shelter place. And then the guy start explaining that, I don't have any money anymore, is because I'm looking after all these dogs.
Oh.
And he renamed Linguini as Porky.
Yeah.
That's so cute.
Yeah.
What else? I think the highlights, there's so many highlights apart from the final scene, the charade, so personal.
Oh, yeah.
It reflects how the connection of the two characters cannot be replaced by any other people.
Exactly. Yeah.
I think the audition for the game show was funny as well.
When she gets high?
Yeah, when she was drug induced.
Yeah. Can I just say, when I accidentally got high in my lifetime, it's not like that.
Oh, is it?
It was more like the hell at the end. You know, when she enters sort of like hell. Yeah, I had
different response.
Narcotics, nap. Yep. But the clouds were so cute. The little clouds around her, it was so cute.
They picked Harry Styles' Watermelon Sugar. That was so funny. It's a background music. Remind me of Booksmart. Was it?
Yeah,
called?
Yeah.
They had a bit of the
scene, yeah, when they
where
also
they
get
go
high.
and animation, you know, they become animated. That was pretty
Yeah,
good.
exactly. And it's like there's an episode in Broad City too when Abby gets her teeth removed, her wisdom teeth, and they accidentally give her too many doses of painkiller. Yeah, and she goes on a trip.
What else in the movie? Oh, I want to talk about the Asian element. I don't know if it happens in the Western families, but the quote, "You're just like your mom," is like a absolutely landmine for me that no one should ever say it to
Say,
an Asian
unless you
woman.
want to get hammered in the
Murdered.
head,
I know.
by Helen. Yeah, so
Because it's such a explosive quote that you should never say to a woman, I think.
yeah, you're just like your mum. I would love to be told I'm just like my mum, because I
I
love my mum.
love what else? Asian element. Okay. The Asian family visiting another better Asian family, comparing yourself to another better
Oh
looking.
yeah, the cousins,
Yeah, the
the
cousin.
cousins. That was really, yeah.
I feel related.
Oh
I
yeah,
mean,
but
we don't have families in Australia, but
yeah.
I do remember quite vividly that when we first, you probably wouldn't remember because you were only 4. When we first arrived in Melbourne, we were taken to visit like our parents' friend or our parents' relative's friend, like long distance that we have no idea about. But they always live in a mansion, and they always have this really good looking older siblings. Yeah, so I feel like, oh, that's an experience I had when I was growing up.
Yeah, because you were 12.
Yeah, visiting like a better, wealthier Asian family.
Yeah, right. Interesting.
What else about the with the Asian element? Awkwafina's her job as a
Accountant or a numbers
it's
person? Yeah.
an internal audit. Yeah, when I saw
Yeah, oh.
that, so when I when the scene that popped up with Excel spreadsheet, it's
Yeah.
like, it giving me the headache. Like I
Yeah.
never want to see sitting in front of a computer and staring at Excel
And
sheet
look at
all day.
numbers. I know.
Oh
Yeah, actually, this came out with my work the other day. We were talking about Excel spreadsheets, and like all of us, like me and my female colleagues, were like, it is such a foreign document, and I actually don't know how to do it. I don't know how to, you know how they're like the Excel spreadsheet, there are,
my God.
yeah, there
Yeah,
are actual modes. Like I know my partner, he's like very good at it, and like he knows how to do like code stuff, and just like I like for me, I just
equations and
zero idea what it's meant to do. I'm like tick 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 30 here. No idea how the algorithms work, or like
yeah,
the
it's
sort of
boring.
is there algebra involved? I don't know.
Yes, there is. Yeah, there's a lot of math involved in the Excel sheets. It's a headache. I don't like dealing with it.
Yeah.
There are subtle appearances of bubble tea where Sandra Oh's constantly carrying a drink. I feel like that's quite Asian, where you bubble tea. A scene that my daughter, because I watched it twice, I watched it again with my daughter last night. A scene that we laughed out so loud was when they were on their way to Philadelphia and they start having arguments on in the car and they almost ran into another car and they're
The guy's
like
like, learn
the
to
guy,
drive.
yeah, learn to drive. And Central Coast called him racist. And
Racist.
the car reversed, and then out comes an Asian man.
Yeah, Asian
That
man.
was really funny. And she goes, "Oh, sorry." Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, and also how and Sandra Oh had this quote that she probably said twice or three times in the movie. When she's kind of weaponizes her race by saying,
Oh, I love her. She just keeps calling. She keeps saying, "Do you know how hard it is to be an Asian woman in this country?" And she says it at one point to her own sister.
and everyone nods. Everyone agrees with her because if you don't, they don't agree with her, you're gonna be seen as a racist.
Yeah. I love that line. I would love to just use that line for
Every time.
everywhere. Yeah. Anytime I'm micro attacked, I'm like, It's because I was a person of color. That's why. Like, you can just go around playing the victim card.
Yeah.
Because I'm Asian.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so funny.
Yeah, that was very funny.
I also love. I mean, I've been to Philly. I think Philly is, I wouldn't say it's superior to New York. I mean, it's just a different city, but it is tremendous, and it's absolutely like necessary to visit if you're on the East Coast of the US. Mm-hmm. And I love the hotel they go to. And oh, yeah, Tony Hale, plays Ben Franklin, who's obviously, we all know him as Buster, Arrested Development, yeah. Fantastic actor, love him, and yeah, he's great in that role. But also, the hotel is so cool and kitsch. I would love to actually go stay in a hotel like that.
Yeah, it's got so much culture. So funny, the scene where they trying to check them in, and Sandra Oh is questioning all his what the modern technologies.
Yeah,
in the past, very funny as well. Anything else?
No, I feel like it's a superior film to Joyride.
Oh, yeah,
yeah, yeah. I loved this much more than Joyride.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very upbeat, funny, heartfelt. It's almost like a buddy road trip. It is an absolute delight, I think. For me, it's equally good as Joyride. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's because at the very end, we don't want to spoil for our listeners, just go and watch it. The end Sheree part, it was just like you'll pull your heartstring. So
oh yeah, I yeah, we cried. Yeah, I cried. Yeah,
it's such a clever script, I think. Yeah.
Mm.
Okay, so that's the end of our episode. Remember to subscribe to our podcast on Spotify, Google, and Apple, and give us a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support what we do here at Asian Bitches Down Under, head to Buy Me Coffee page to make a donation for us to continue the intersectionality in the podcast industry. So that's it from us this week, and we'll chat to you next time.
Bye.